anything about it, do we?" said Beauvoir, concentrating on the script and the strange markings above the words. "We don't know if it's old or who wrote it, and we sure don't know what it means. Or why the prior had it. Was he trying to protect it when he died, or was he trying to hide it? Was it precious to him, or was it blasphemy?" "That's interesting," said Beauvoir, examining the page. "I think I figured out what one of the words is. I think this," he pointed to a Latin word written in script, and Gamache leaned toward it, "means ass." Beauvoir handed the page back. "Merci." Gamache returned it for safekeeping and snapped the book shut. "Very enlightening." "Frankly, patron, if you have a monastery full of monks and you come to me for enlightenment, you deserve what you get." Gamache laughed. "C'est vrai. Well, I'm off to find Dom Philippe and see if there's a plan of the abbey. And I want a word with the soloist, Frère Antoine." "The one who challenged the abbot?" "That's him," said Beauvoir. "Must be one of the prior's men." "What is it?" Gamache had grown very still, listening. The monastery, always quiet, seemed to be holding its breath. But with the first notes of the chant, it breathed. "Not again," sighed Beauvoir. "Didn't we just have one? Honestly, they're worse than crackheads." "Up and down, bow, sit, stand." The post-breakfast service called Lords went on and on. But now Beauvoir found himself less bored. Probably, he told himself, because he knew some members of the band. He was also paying more attention, seeing it as more than just a waste of time between interrogations and collecting evidence. The prayer service itself was evidence. The Gregorian chants. All the suspects lined up, facing each other. Was the rift obvious? Could he see it, now that he knew? Beauvoir found himself fascinated by the ritual. And the monks. "This was the prior's last service," whispered Gamache, as they bowed, then straightened. Beauvoir noticed the chief's right hand was steady, no tremor today.
"He was killed almost immediately after Lourdes yesterday." "We still don't know for sure where he went after Lourdes," whispered Beauvoir, as they briefly sat. It was, he'd grown to realize, a tease. Within moments they were back on their feet.
"True. When this is over, we need to watch which monks go where."
The chief kept his eyes on the rows of monks. The sun was just rising, and, as Lourdes went on, more and more light descended from the windows high up in the central tower. It hit the imperfect old glass and refracted, split, into all the colours ever created, and those tumbled to the altar and lit the monks and their music, so that it seemed that the notes and the cheerful light mixed and merged, playing together on the altar. Most of Gamache's experience with the church had been fairly grim, so he'd sought, and found, his God elsewhere. But this was different. There was delight here, and not by pure chance. Gamache took his eyes off the monks for a moment and looked to the ceiling, the beams and buttresses, and the windows. The original architect of Saint-Gilbert-Entre-les-Loups had deliberately created an abbey that was a vessel for light and sound. Perfect acoustics married playful light. He lowered his gaze. The monks' voices seemed even more beautiful than yesterday, tinged with sorrow now, but there was also a levity to the notes, a lift. The chants were both solemn and joyous, grounded and winged. And Gamache thought again about the page with the old neumes that he'd slipped for safekeeping into the Book of Meditations. The neumes looked, at times, like wings in flight. Was that what the composer of the ancient chants had tried to get across? That this music wasn't really of this earth? Beauvoir had been right, of course. The music had both touched Gamache and transported him. He was tempted to lose himself in the gentle, calming voices, so in tune with each other, to drop the worries he carried and drift away, to forget why he was there. It was infectious, insidious. Gamache smiled and realized to blame the music was ludicrous. If he drifted away, lost focus, it was his fault, and not the monks, not the music. He doubled his efforts and scanned the rows. Like a game, but not a game. Find the leader. With the prior gone, who now led this world-famous choir? Because someone did. As he'd said to Beauvoir, choirs don't direct themselves. One of the monks, with movement so subtle as to be lost on even a trained investigator, had taken charge. When Lords ended, the chief and Beauvoir stood in their pew, watching. It was, thought Beauvoir, a bit like taking the break in a game of pool, balls heading off in all directions. That's what this looked like, monks going here, there, and everywhere, scattering, though not actually bouncing off the walls. Beauvoir turned to say something sarcastic to Gamache, but changed his mind when he saw the chief's face. It was stern, thoughtful. Jean-Guy followed the chief's gaze and saw Frère Luc walking slowly, perhaps reluctantly, toward the wooden door that would take him down the long, long corridor, to the locked door, the gate, and the tiny room marked Porterie. He was all alone and looked it. Beauvoir turned back to the chief and saw in his eyes a look that was both sharp and concerned. And he wondered if the chief was seeing Frère Luc but thinking about other young men who'd gone through a door and not returned, who'd followed Gamache's orders, followed Gamache. But while the chief had come back with a deep scar near his temple and a tremor in his hand, they hadn't. Was the chief looking at Frère Luc but thinking about them? Gamache seemed worried. "Okay, patron?" whispered Beauvoir. The acoustics in the Blessed Chapel picked up the words and magnified them. Chief Inspector didn't answer. Instead, he continued to stare at the now-closed door, where Frère Luc had gone and disappeared. Alone. The other black-robed monks went through all the other doors. Finally, they were alone in the Blessed Chapel, and Gamache turned back to Beauvoir. "I know you want to speak with Frère Antoine." "The soloist," said Beauvoir. "Yes."
"That's a good idea. But I wonder if you'd mind joining Frère Luc first."
"Sure. But what'll I ask him? You've already spoken to him. So have I, in the shower this morning."
"Find out if Frère Antoine knew he was about to be replaced as soloist on the next album. Just keep Frère Luc company for a while. See if anyone else shows up at the porter's door in the next half hour."
Beauvoir looked at his watch. The service had started bang on 7:30 and ended exactly 45 minutes later. "Oui, patron," he said. Gamache's eyes hadn't left that dim part of the church. Beauvoir willingly followed Frère Luc, just as he willingly followed all of Gamache's orders. He knew it was a waste of time, of course. The chief might make it sound like more interrogation, but Beauvoir knew what it really was. Babysitting. He was happy to do it, if it gave the chief some peace. Beauvoir would have burped and diapered the monk, had Gamache asked, and had it helped ease the chief's mind. "Would you mind having a look, Simon?" The abbot smiled at his taciturn secretary, then turned to his guest. "Shall we?" The abbot raised an arm and pointed, like a good host, to the two comfortable armchairs by the fireplace. The chairs were covered in a faded chintz and seemed to be stuffed with feathers. The abbot was about 10 years older than Gamache, mid-60s, the chief guest, but he seemed sort of ageless. The shaved head and robes, Gamache supposed, did that. Though there was no disguising the lines in Dom Philippe's face, and no attempt to disguise them. "Brother Simon will find you a plan of the monastery. I'm sure we have one somewhere."
"You don't use one?"
"Good heavens, no. I know every stone, every crack." Like a commander of a ship, thought Gamache, coming up through the ranks, intimately aware of every corner of his vessel. The abbot seemed comfortable in command, apparently unaware a mutiny was underway. Or probably supremely aware there had been one, and it had been thwarted. The challenge to his authority had died with the prior. Dom Philippe smoothed his long, pale hands over the arms of his chair. "When I first joined Saint-Gilbert, one of the monks was an upholsterer, self-taught. He'd ask the abbot to get the ends of bolts and bring them back. This is his work. The abbot's hand stopped moving and rested on the arm, as though it was the arm of the monk himself. That was almost 40 years ago now. He was elderly then, and died a few years after I arrived. Frère Roland was his name, a gentle, quiet man.
Do you remember all the monks?
I do, Chief Inspector. Do you remember all your brothers?
I'm an only child, I'm afraid.
I put it badly. I meant your other brothers, your brothers in arms. The chief felt himself grow still.
I remember every name, every face.
The abbot held his gaze. It wasn't challenging, it wasn't even searching. It felt, to Gamache, more like a hand to the elbow, helping him keep his balance. I thought you probably did.
Unfortunately, none of my agents is quite this handy.
Gamache also smoothed the faded chintz. If you lived and worked here, believe me, they'd become handy even if they didn't start that way.
You recruit everyone?
The abbot nodded. I have to go get them. Because of our history, we've taken not just a vow of silence, but a vow of invisibility. A pledge to keep our monastery... He searched for a word. It was clearly not something Dom Philippe had had to explain very often, if ever.
A secret?
Offered Gamache. The abbot smiled. I was trying to avoid that word, but I suppose it's accurate. The Gilbertine had a happy, uneventful life for many centuries in England, and then with the Reformation all the monasteries were closed. That's when we first started fading. We packed up everything we could carry and disappeared from sight. We found a fairly remote piece of land and rebuilt in France. Then, with the Inquisitions, we again came under scrutiny. The Holy Office interpreted our desire for seclusion as a desire for secrecy, and judged us badly.
"And you don't want to be judged badly by the Inquisition," said Gamache.
"You don't want to be judged at all by the Inquisition. Ask the Waldensians."
"The who?"
"Exactly. They live not far from us in France, a few valleys over. We saw the smoke, inhaled the smoke, heard the screams." Dom Philippe paused, then looked down at his hands clasping each other in his lap. He spoke, Gamache realized, as though he'd been there himself, breathing in his brother monks. "So we packed up again," said the abbot.
"Faded further?"
The abbot nodded. "As far as we could get. We came over to the New World with some of the first settlers. The Jesuits were the ones chosen to convert the natives and head out with the explorers."
"While the Gilbertine did what?"
"While we paddled north." The abbot paused then. "When I say we came across with the first settlers, I meant that we came across as settlers, not as monks. We hid our robes, hid our holy orders."
"Why?"
"Because we were worried."
"Does that explain the thick walls and hidden rooms and locked doors?"
asked Gamache. "So you've noticed those?" asked the abbot with a smile.
"I'm a trained observer, mon père," said Gamache. "Hardly anything gets by my keen eye."
The abbot gave a soft laugh. He, like the chants themselves, seemed lighter this morning, less burdened. "We appear to be an order of warriors."
"I notice that Saint-Gilbert doesn't seem to have a calling," said Gamache. "Perhaps he can become the patron saint of fretters."
"It would certainly fit. I'll alert the Holy Father," said the abbot. While recognizing the joke, the chief inspector suspected this abbot wanted little, if anything, to do with bishops, archbishops, or popes. The Gilbertine, more than anything, just wanted to be left alone. Dom Philippe moved his hand back to the arm of his chair, his finger probing a hole worn in the fabric. It seemed new to him, a surprise. "We're used to solving our own problems," he said, looking at the chief. "From roof repairs, to broken heating, to cancer and broken bones. Every single monk who lives here will die here, too. We leave everything up to God, from holes in the fabric, to harvests, to how and when we die." Was what happened in your garden yesterday God's work? The abbot shook his head. That's why I decided to call you in. We can handle God's will, no matter how harsh it can sometimes appear. But this was something else. It was man's will, and we needed help. And not everyone in your community agrees. You're thinking of Brother Antoine last night at dinner? I am. And he was clearly not alone. No. The abbot shook his head, but held Gamache's eyes. I've learned in more than 2 decades as abbot that not everyone will agree with my decisions. I can't worry about that.
What do you worry about, mon père?
I worry about telling the difference.
I'm sorry.
Between God's will and my will. And right now, I'm worried about who killed Mathieu and why. He paused, worrying the hole in the upholstery, making it worse. And how I could have missed it.
Frère Simon arrived with a scroll and unrolled it on the low pine table in front of the men.
Merci, Simon, said the abbot, and leaned forward. Frère Simon made to leave, but Gamache stopped him.
I have another request, I'm afraid. It would be helpful to have a schedule of the services and meals, and anything else we should be aware of.
An horarium, said the abbot. Simon, would you mind?
It seemed Simon, while looking as though he minded breathing, in fact was willing to do anything the abbot asked of him. One of the abbot's men, without a doubt, thought Gamache. Simon withdrew, and the 2 men leaned over the plan.
So, said Beauvoir, leaning against the door jamb, do you spend all day here?
All day, every day.
And what do you do?
Even to his ears it sounded like a lame pick-up line in a dingy bar.
Come here often, sweet cheeks? Next he'd be asking this young monk what his sign was. Beauvoir was Cancer, which always annoyed him. He wanted to be Scorpio, or Leo, or even that ram thing. Anything other than the crab that, according to the descriptions, was nurturing, nesting, and sensitive. Fucking horoscopes.
I read this.
Frère Luc lifted the huge book an inch off his lap, then dropped it again.
What is it?
Frère Luc gave him a suspicious look, as though trying to assess the motives of the man he met in the shower that morning. Beauvoir had to admit he'd be suspicious of himself, too.
It's the Book of Gregorian Chants. I study it, learn my parts.
It was the perfect in.
You told me this morning that the prior had chosen you to be the new soloist in the next recording. You'd be replacing Frère Antoine. Did Frère Antoine know that?
Must have, said Luc.
Why do you say that?
Because if Frère Antoine thought he was the soloist, he'd be studying the chants, not me.
All the chants are in that one book?
Looking at it, balanced on Frère Luc's thin knees, Beauvoir had an idea.
Who else knows about that?
Beauvoir nodded toward the old volume.
If knowledge was power, thought Beauvoir, that book was all-powerful. It held the key to their vocation. And now it was also the key to all their wealth and influence. Whoever possessed this book had everything. It was their holy grail.
Everyone. It's kept on a lectern in the Blessed Chapel. We look at it all the time. Take it to ourselves sometimes. No big deal.
Merde, thought Beauvoir. So much for the holy grail.
We also copy out the chants ourselves. Frère Luc pointed to a workbook on the narrow table. So we all have our own copies.
It's not a secret, then? Asked Beauvoir, to be sure.
This? The young monk laid his hand on it. Many monasteries have one. Most have 2 or 3, and far more impressive ones than ours. I guess because this is such a poor order, we only have one, so we have to be careful with it.
Not read it in the bath? Asked Beauvoir.
Luc smiled. It was the first one Beauvoir had seen from the grim young monk.
When were you supposed to do the new recording?
It wasn't decided yet.
Beauvoir thought about that for a moment.
What wasn't decided? The timing of the recording, or if there'd even be one?
It wasn't absolutely decided there'd be another recording, but I don't think there was much doubt.
But you led the chief to believe the recording was going ahead, a fait accompli. Now you're saying it wasn't?
It was just a matter of time, said Luke. If the prior wanted something, it happened.
And Frère Antoine? Asked Beauvoir. How do you think he took the news?
He'd have accepted it. He'd have to.
Not because Frère Antoine was humble, thought Beauvoir, not as a reflection of his faith, but because it was useless to argue with the prior. Easier, probably, to just kill the man.
Was that the motive? Had Frère Antoine smashed the prior's head in because he was about to be replaced as soloist? In an order dedicated to Gregorian chant, the soloist would hold a special place. A more equal, as Orwell had it, than others. And people killed for that all the time.
Chapter 15. The sunshine through the leaded glass windows fell on the plan of the Abbey of Saint-Gilbert-Entre-les-Loups. It was drawn on very old, very thick paper, and showed the cruciform design of the abbey. Walled enclosures jutted off the two arms, and the abbot's garden hung off the bottom of the cross. The chief inspector put on his reading glasses and leaned closer to the scroll. He studied the drawing in silence. He'd been in the abbot's garden, of course, and had collected eggs with Frère Bernard a few hours ago in the walled enclosure with the goats and sheep and chickens off the right arm of the cross. His eyes shifted across the plan to the opposite arm, with the chocolate factory, the dining hall, the kitchens, and another walled enclosure.
What's this, mon père?
The chief pointed. That's our vegetable and herb garden. We grow our own, of course.
Enough to feed all of you?
That's why we've never had more than 24 monks. It was judged by the founders to be the perfect number, enough to do the work and not too many to feed. They were right.
And yet you have 30 cells. Room for more. Why?
Just in case, said Dom Philippe. As you so rightly said, Chief Inspector, we're an order of fretters. Suppose we needed more space. Suppose someone came. We're prepared for the unexpected. Though the perfect number is 24.
But now you're down to 23. A spot has opened up.
I suppose it has. I hadn't thought that far ahead. The chief inspector wondered if that was true, and wondered if that might make a motive. If the abbot did the recruiting, could he have found another monk he wanted to invite to join the Gilbertine? But someone would have to go before the new person could come. And who better than the troublesome prior? Gamache tucked that possibility away, but without any great enthusiasm. Even in the cutthroat world of universities or New York co-ops, where there were finite places, people rarely actually cut throats or bashed in skulls. He could see many reasons this abbot might kill his prior, but to open up a space for someone else seemed among the least likely.
Who was the last person you recruited?
Brother Luke. He came just under a year ago, from an order close to the American border. They're also a musical order. Benedictines. Make wonderful cheese. We trade chocolate for their cheese. You had some at breakfast.
Delicious, agreed the chief, who wanted to get off cheese and back to the murder. Why did you choose him?
I'd had my eye on him since he entered the seminary. Beautiful voice. Extraordinary voice.
And what else does he bring?
Pardon?
I understand that singing might be what you look for first.
I look for piety first, said the abbot. His voice was still pleasant, but there was no mistaking his tone. He wanted to make that clear. First, I must believe that a brother will fit in with the goal of Saint-Gilbert, to live with God through Christ. If that's satisfied, then I look at other things.
Like his voice, said Gamache. But there has to be more, no? Another skill he brings. As you say, you need to be self-sufficient.
For the first time, the abbot hesitated, looked uncomfortable. Frère Luc has the advantage of youth. He can be taught.
But Gamache had seen the crack, the chink, the fret, and he moved in.
And yet, every other monk came with a discipline. For instance,
I understand Frère Alexandre is getting old, perhaps too old to look after the animals. Wouldn't it make more sense to find a replacement for him?
Are you questioning my judgment?
I certainly am. I'm questioning everything. Why did you recruit Frère Luc when all he could bring was his voice?
I judged that his voice was enough at this stage. As I said, he can be taught other things, like animal husbandry from Frère Alexandre, if he shows an aptitude for it. We're fortunate now.
How so?
We don't need to beg other monks to come. Younger monks are interested. That was one of the great gifts of the recording. We now have a choice. And when they arrive, we can train them. An older monk can mentor a younger, as Frère Roland was mentored and learned the trade of upholstering.
Perhaps Frère Luc can learn it, too, said Gamache, and saw the abbot smile.
That's not a bad idea, Chief Inspector. Merci.
Still, thought Gamache, it didn't quite explain the volte face the abbot had made in recruiting. From choosing skilled and trained men to choosing a novice, with only one outstanding skill, his extraordinary voice. Gamache stared at the plan on the table in front of them. There was something wrong with it. Some sense he had, like in the funhouse. A slight queasiness when he looked at it.
"Is there just the one hidden room?" he asked, his finger hovering over the chapter house.
"As far as I know, there are always rumours of long-forgotten tunnels and vaults with treasure, but no one's ever found them, at least not that I know of."
"And what did the rumours say the treasure was?"
"That was conveniently unclear," said the abbot with a smile. "Couldn't have been much, since the original 24 monks would have had to paddle it up the river all the way from Quebec City. And I can tell you, if you couldn't eat it or wear it, it probably didn't come on the voyage."
Since those were pretty much his own packing rules, Gamache accepted the abbot's explanation. Besides, what could men who'd taken vows of silence, poverty, and isolation possibly treasure? Though even as he asked himself that question, he knew the answer. People always found things to treasure. For little boys, it was arrowheads and cat's-eye marbles. For adolescents, it was a cool T-shirt and a signed baseball. And for big boys, just because they were monks didn't mean they had no treasures. It simply might not be what others found valuable. He rested his hand on the end of the plan to keep the paper from curling up, then looked over to where his fingers touched.
"It's the same paper," he said, caressing the plan.
"Same as what?" asked the abbot.
"As this."
Once again, the chief brought the page from the book and laid it on top of the plan.
"The chant is written on exactly the same paper as the plan for the monastery. Is it possible this," he touched the chant, "is as old as that?"
He nodded to the plan of the monastery.
"Were they written at the same time?"
The drawing was dated 1634 and signed Dom Clément, abbot of Saint-Gilbert-Entre-les-Loups. Below the signature were two figures Gamache had grown to recognize, wolves, intertwined, apparently sleeping.
Entre-les-Loups,
among the wolves. It suggested coming to an agreement, finding peace rather than banishment or massacre. Perhaps when you flee an Inquisition, you're less likely to visit those horrors on others, even wolves. Gamache compared the lettering. Both were simple, the letters not so much written as drawn, calligraphied. They looked to be done by a similar hand. He'd need an expert to say if the plan and the chant were written by the same man, in 1634.
Dom Philippe shook his head.
"It's certainly the same type of paper. But is it the same vintage? I think the chant was written much more recently, and whoever did it used vellum to make it look old. We have sheets of vellum still, made by monks centuries ago, before paper."
"Where do you keep them?"
"Simon," the abbot called, and the monk appeared. "Can you show the chief inspector our vellum?"
Frère Simon looked put out, as though this was far too much effort. But he nodded and walked across the room, followed by Gamache. He pulled out a drawer filled with sheets of yellowed paper.
"Are any missing?" asked Gamache.
"Don't know," said Simon. "I never counted."
"What do you use them for?"
Nothing. They just sit here, in case. In case of what? Gamache wondered. Or just in case.
Who could have taken one? He asked, feeling he was caught in a perpetual game of 20 questions.
Anyone, said Frère Simon, closing the drawer. It's never locked.
But is your office locked?
Gamache turned back to the abbot.
Never.
It was locked when we arrived, said the chief.
I did that, said Frère Simon. Wanted to make sure nothing was disturbed when I came to get you.
Did you also lock it when you went to find the doctor and the abbot?
Oui.
Why?
I didn't want anyone to come across the body. The monk was getting defensive, his eyes darting from Gamache to the abbot, who sat quietly listening.
Did you know it was murder at the time?
I knew it wasn't natural.
How many people use the abbot's garden? The chief asked, and again saw the monk's eyes shoot off to the abbot, then back again.
No one, said Dom Philippe, getting up and coming over.
To the rescue? Gamache wondered. It had that feel. But it wasn't clear why Frère Simon needed rescuing.
As I believe I mentioned earlier, Chief Inspector, this is my private garden, a sort of sanctuary. Mathieu used to visit, and Frère Simon does the gardening, but beyond that it's used only by me.
Why? Gamache asked. Most other places in the abbey are communal. Why is your garden private?
You'd have to ask Dom Clément, said the abbot. He designed the abbey. He put in the garden and the hidden chapter house and everything else. He was a master architect, you know, renowned in his time. You can see his brilliance.
Gamache nodded. He could, and brilliance was exactly the right word, not only in the simple, elegant lines, but in the placement of the windows. Every stone was there for a reason, nothing superfluous, nothing ornate. All had a reason for being, and there was a reason the abbot's garden was private, if not secret.
Gamache turned back to Frère Simon.
If no one else used the garden, why did you think one of the monks might stumble across the body of Frère Mathieu?
I hadn't expected to find the prior there, said Simon. I didn't know what else to expect.
There was silence then, as Gamache studied the guarded monk. Then the chief nodded and turned back to the abbot.
We were talking about the sheet of paper found on the body of the prior. You think the paper's old, but the writing isn't. Why do you say that?
The two men returned to their chairs, while Frère Simon hovered in the background, tidying, shifting papers, watching, listening.
The ink's too dark, for one thing, said Dom Philippe, as they studied the page. Vellum soaks up liquid over time, so that what's left on the surface isn't really ink anymore, but a stain in the shape of the words. You can see that in the plan of the monastery.
Gamache leaned over the scroll. The abbot was right. He thought with the passage of time and exposure to the sun, the black ink had faded slightly, but it hadn't. It had been absorbed into the vellum. The colour was now trapped inside the page, not resting on top.
But that, the abbot waved to the yellowed paper, hasn't sunk in yet.
Gamache frowned, impressed. He'd still consult a forensic expert, but he suspected the abbot might be right. The yellowed chant wasn't old at all, just made to look that way. Made to deceive.
Who would have done this? Gamache asked.
I can't know.
Let me rephrase that, then. Who could have done this? Now, I can tell you, not many people can sing a Gregorian chant, never mind write one, even a mockery of one, using these.
He placed his index finger firmly over one of the neumes.
We live in different realities, Chief Inspector. What's obvious to you isn't to me.
He left and returned a moment later with a workbook, clearly modern, and opened it. Inside, on the left page, were Latin text and the squiggled neumes. On the right was the same text, but this time instead of neumes there were musical notes.
This is the same chant, Dom Philippe explained. One side's in the old form, with neumes, and the other's in modern notes.
Who did this?
I did. An early attempt to transcribe the old chants.
Not very good or accurate, I'm afraid. The later ones are better. Where did you get the old chant? Gamache pointed to the Neum side. From our book of chants. Before you get excited, Chief Inspector, yet again, Gamache realized even slight shifts in his expression were readable by these monks, and a tiny ripple of interest was considered excited in this placid place. Let me tell you that many monasteries have at least one, often many, books of chants. Ours is among the least interesting. No illuminated script, no illustrations. Pretty dull by church standards. All the impoverished Gilbertine could afford at the time, I suspect. Where's your book of chants kept? Was this the treasure, Gamache wondered, kept hidden? Was one monk assigned to guard it, perhaps even the dead prior? How powerful would that make, Frère Mathieu? It's kept on a lectern in the Blessed Chapel, said the abbot. It's a huge book, left open, though I think Frère Luc has it now in the porterie, studying it. The abbot gave an infinitesimal smile. He could see the slight disappointment on the chief's face. It was disconcerting, Gamache realized, to be so easily read. It also took away an assumed advantage an investigator had, that suspects didn't know what the police were thinking. But it seemed this abbot knew, or could guess, just about everything. Although Dom Philippe wasn't all-seeing, all-knowing, after all, he hadn't known he had a murderer among them. Or perhaps he had. You must read Neum's well, said the chief, returning to the abbot's workbook, to have transcribed them into musical notes. I wish that was true. I'm not the worst, but I'm far from the best. We all do it. When a monk arrives in Saint-Gilbert, it's the first task he's given, like Frère Luc, to start transcribing the Gregorian chants from our old book into modern musical notes. Why? As a sort of test, first off. See how dedicated the monk really is. For someone not truly passionate about Gregorian chant, it's a long and tedious chore. It's a good way to weed out any dilettantes. And for those who are passionate? It's heaven. We can hardly wait to get at the book. Since it sits on the lectern, we can consult it whenever we want. The abbot dropped his eyes to the workbook and flipped through it, smiling, sometimes shaking his head and even tisking over some mistake. Gamache was reminded of his children, Daniel and Annie, looking through albums of photos taken when they were kids, laughing and sometimes cringing at hairstyle and clothing choices. These monks had no photo albums, no family pictures. Instead, they had workbooks with neums and notes. Chants had replaced family. How long does it take to do the whole book of chants? A lifetime. It can take a year to transcribe a single chant. It becomes a surprisingly beautiful relationship, very intimate. The abbot seemed to detach just for a moment, go someplace else. A place without walls and murder and a Sûreté officer asking questions. And then he came back. Since the work is so long and complex, most of us die before we're finished.
What happened just now? Asked Gamache.
Pardon?
As you spoke about the music, your eyes seemed to become unfocused. It felt as though you drifted off.
The abbot turned his full attention and very alert eyes on the chief, but said nothing.
I've seen that look before, said Gamache. When you sing, not just you, but all of you.
It's joy, I suppose, said the abbot. When I even think of the chants, I feel freed of cares. It's as close to God as I can get.
But Gamache had seen that look on other faces, in stinking, filthy, squalid rooms, under bridges and in cold back alleys, on the faces of the living and sometimes on the dead. It was ecstasy, of sorts. Those people got there not through chants, but through needles in the arm, crack pipes and little pills. And sometimes they never came back. If religion was the opiate of the masses, what did that make chants?
If you're all transcribing the same chants, said the chief, thinking about what the abbot had been saying before he drifted off, can't you just copy off each other?
Cheat? You do live in a different world.
It was a question, said Gamache with a smile, not a suggestion.
I suppose we could. But this isn't a chore. The point isn't to transcribe the chants. It's to get to know them, live inside the music, to see the voice of God in each note, each word, each breath. Anyone who'd want to take a shortcut wouldn't want to dedicate his life to Gregorian chant and spend it here in Saint-Gilbert.
Has anyone ever finished the whole book of chants?
A few monks, to my knowledge, and no one in my lifetime.
And what happens to their workbooks after they die?
They're burned, in a ceremony.
You burn books?
The shock on Gamache's face didn't need much interpretation. We do. Just as Tibetan monks spend years and years creating their intricate works of art in sand, and then destroy them the moment they're finished. The point is not to grow attached to things. The gift is the music, not the workbook.
But it must be painful.
It is. But faith is often painful, and often joyous. Two halves of a whole.
So, Gamache turned his attention back to the yellowed page lying on the plan of the monastery. You don't think this is actually all that old?
I don't.
What else can you tell me about it?
What's clear, and why I showed you my workbook, is the difference between the chants.
The abbot placed the yellow page on his workbook so that it covered the modern translation. The two chants with neumes faced each other. The chief inspector studied them. He spent almost a minute in complete silence, staring, looking from one to the other, at the words and at the marks flitting all over the pages. Then his eyes slowed, and he stared longer at one, then the other. When he lifted his eyes, there was a spark of discovery in them, and the abbot smiled, as he might to a bright postulant.
"The neumes are different," said Gamache.
"No, not different. But there are more of them on the page we found on the prior, far more. Now that I see the two examples side by side, it seems obvious. The one in your notebook, copied from the original, has just a few neumes per line. But the one we found on the prior is thick with them."
"Exactly."
"So, what does it mean?"
"Again, I can't be sure." The abbot leaned over the yellow page. "Neumes serve only one purpose, Chief Inspector, to give direction. Up, down, fast, slow. They're signs, signals, like the hands of a conductor. I think whoever wrote this means for there to be many voices going in different directions. This isn't plain chant. This is complex chant, multi-layered chant. It's also quite fast, a strong tempo, and..."
Now the abbot hesitated.
"Yes?"
"As I say, I'm not exactly the resident expert. Mathieu was that. But I think this was also meant to have music. I think one of the lines of neumes is for an instrument."
"And that would be different from Gregorian chants?"
"It would make it a new creature, something never heard before."
Gamache studied the yellowed page.
How odd, he thought, that monks never seen should possess something never heard. And one of them, their prior, had been found dead, curled around it in the fetal position, like a mother protecting an unborn child, or a brother in arms curled around a grenade. He wished he knew which it was, divine or damned.
"Is there an instrument here?"
"There's a piano."
"A piano? Were you planning to eat it or wear it?"
The abbot laughed. "One of the monks arrived with it years ago, and we hadn't the heart to send it back."
The abbot smiled.
"We're dedicated to Gregorian chants, passionate about them. But the fact is, we love all church music. Many of the brothers are fine musicians. We have recorders and violins. Or are they fiddles? I'm never sure what the difference is."
"One sings, the other dances," said Gamache.
The abbot looked at him with interest. "What a nice way of putting it."
"A colleague told me that. I learned a great deal from him."
"Would he like to become a monk?"
"I'm afraid he's beyond that now."
The abbot again correctly interpreted the look on Gamache's face and didn't press.
Gamache picked up the page. "I don't suppose you have a photocopy machine?"
No, but we have 23 monks.
Gamache smiled and handed it over to the abbot. "Can you have it transcribed?
If you can make a copy, that would be helpful, so I don't need to keep carrying around the original. And perhaps one of you could transcribe the neumes into musical notes? Is that possible?
We can try.
Dom Philippe called his secretary over and explained what was needed.
Transcribe it to musical notes?
Simon asked. He looked not very optimistic. The Eeyore of the monastery.
Eventually. Just copy it for now so we can give the original back to the chief inspector. As accurately as possible, of course.
Of course, said Simon. The abbot turned away, but Gamache caught the flash of a sour look on Simon's face, aimed at the abbot's back. Was he the abbot's man, after all? The chief wondered. Gamache glanced through the leaded glass window. It made the world outside look slightly distorted, but still he yearned to step into it, and stand in the sunshine. Away even briefly from this interior world of subtle glances and vague alliances, of notes and veiled expressions, of vacant looks and ecstasy. Gamache longed to walk around the abbot's garden. No matter how tilled and weeded and pruned it was, that control was an illusion. There was no taming nature. And then he realized what had made him uncomfortable earlier when he'd first seen the plan of the monastery. He looked at it again. The walled gardens. On the plan they were all the same size, but in reality they weren't. The abbot's garden was much smaller than the Animalerie. But on the plan they appeared exactly the same size. The original architects, perhaps Dom Clément himself, had distorted the drawing. The perspectives were off. Things appeared equal that weren't.
Chapter 16 Inspector Beauvoir left Trois-Luc to the massive book resting on his skinny knees. He'd arrived, thinking the poor bastard must want company, and left realizing he'd been simply an intrusion. All the young monk really wanted was to be left alone with his book. Jean-Guy went off in search of Frère Antoine, but paused in the Blessed Chapel to check his BlackBerry. Sure enough, there were two messages from Annie, both short, responding to his email from early that morning, and a more recent one describing her day so far. Beauvoir leaned against the cool stones of the chapel and smiled as he wrote back. Something rude and suggestive. He was tempted to tell her about her father's adventures that morning, in his pajamas and bathrobe, being found by the monks on their altar. But it was too good a story to waste in an email. He'd take her to one of the terraces not far from her home and tell her over a glass of wine. When he'd finished his vaguely erotic message to Annie, he turned right and looked in the chocolate factory. Brother Bernard was there, fishing tiny wild blueberries out of a vat of dark chocolate. "Frère Antoine," said Bernard, responding to the Sûreté officer's question, "try either the kitchen or the garden."
"The garden?"
"Through the door at the end of the hall." He waved a wooden spoon and dribbled chocolate on his apron. He looked like he wanted to swear, and Beauvoir paused, wondering how monks cursed. Like the rest of the Québécois? Like Beauvoir himself? Did they curse the church? Calice? Tabernacle? Hostie? The Québécois had turned religious words into dirty words. But the monk remained silent, and Beauvoir left, glancing into the gleaming stainless steel kitchen next door. It was easy to see where some of the music money had been spent. There was no Frère Antoine, only the aroma of a soup simmering and bread baking. Finally, Beauvoir reached the large wooden door at the very end of the corridor and opened it. He felt a rush of autumn air, cool and fresh, and the sunshine on his face. He'd had no idea how much he missed the sun until it was back, and now he took a deep breath and stepped into the garden. The abbot's bookcase swung open to reveal to Gamache a bright, fresh world of green grass, and the last of the blooms, of neat shrubs, and the huge maple in the middle losing its autumn leaves. As the chief watched, a single bright orange leaf lost its grip and wafted back and forth, gently falling to the ground. This was a walled world, with a pretense of control, without the reality of it.
Gamache felt his foot sink into the soft grass and smelt musky autumn in the morning air. Insects buzzed and droned, almost drunk on the late September nectar. It was chilly, but milder than the chief had expected. The walls, he supposed, acted as a wind barrier and a sun trap, creating their own environment. Gamache had asked to come into the garden not simply because he yearned for fresh air and sunshine, but because this was almost the exact moment 24 hours earlier when two other men had stood here. Frère Mathieu and his killer. And now the chief inspector of homicide and the abbot of Saint-Gilbert stood there. Gamache looked at his watch. Just after 8:30 in the morning. When exactly had the prior's companion known what he was going to do? Had he come into the garden, stood where the chief now stood, with murder in mind? Had he stooped and picked up a stone and bashed in the prior's skull on impulse? Or had that been his plan all along? When was the decision made to murder? And when did Frère Mathieu know he was about to be killed? Had been killed, in fact. It had clearly taken him a few minutes after the blow was struck to die. He'd crawled to the far wall, away from the abbey, away from the bright and warm sunshine, into the darkness. Was it simply instinct, as someone had suggested, an animal wanting to die alone? Or was something else at work? Had the prior one last service to perform? To protect the yellow page against the monks, or the monks from the yellowed page? "You were inspecting the new geothermal system yesterday morning at this time," said Gamache. "Alone?" The abbot nodded. "The morning's a busy time in the abbey. The brothers are in the garden, or tending the animals, doing all sorts of chores. It takes near constant work to keep the abbey up." "Is one of your monks in charge of the physical plant?" The abbot nodded. "Frère Raymond. He looks after the infrastructure, the plumbing and heating and electrics, that sort of thing."
"So you met with him?"
"Well, no."
The abbot turned and started strolling slowly around the garden, and Gamache joined him.
"What do you mean, no?"
"Brother Raymond wasn't there. He works in the garden every morning after Lourdes."
"And that's when you chose to inspect the geothermal?" asked Gamache, perplexed. "Wouldn't you want him there, to go over it together?"
The abbot smiled. "Have you met Brother Raymond?"
Gamache shook his head.
"A lovely man, gentleman, an explainer."
"A what?"
"He loves to explain how things work, and why. It doesn't matter that he told me every day for 14 years how an artesian well works, he'll still tell me again."
The whimsical, affectionate look remained on Dom Philippe's face.
"Some days I'm very bad," he confided in the chief, "and sneak down to do my rounds when I know he won't be there."
The chief smiled. He had a few agents and inspectors like that, who literally followed him through the halls explaining the intricacies of fingerprints. He'd hidden in his office more than once to avoid them.
"And your secretary, Brother Simon? He tried to find the prior, but when he couldn't, he went to work in the animalerie, I understand."
"That's right. He's very fond of chickens."
Gamache studied the abbot to see if he was joking, but he seemed perfectly serious. Jean-Guy looked at the garden. It was huge, much, much bigger than the abbot's garden. This was clearly a vegetable garden, whose main crop seemed to be massive mushrooms. A dozen monks, in their black robes, were kneeling down or bending over. On their heads they wore large, extravagant straw hats, with wide, floppy brims. One man wearing it would look ridiculous, but since all of them were, it looked normal. And Beauvoir, bareheaded, became the abnormal one. Plants were staked up, vines were trailed along trellises, neat rows were being weeded by some of the mushrooms, while others gathered vegetables in baskets. Beauvoir was reminded of his grandmother, who lived all her life on a farm. Short and stocky, she'd spent half her life loving the church and the other half loathing it. When Jean-Guy had visited, they'd collect little new peas together and shell them, sitting on the porch.
He now knew his grandmother must have been very busy, but she never gave that impression, just as these monks now gave the impression of working steadily, working hard even, but working at their own pace. Beauvoir found himself almost mesmerized by the rhythm of their movements, standing, bowing, kneeling. It reminded him of something, and then he had it. Had they been singing, this would be a mass. Did this explain his grandmother's love of her garden? As she stood and bowed and knelt, had it become her mass, her devotion? Had she found in her garden the peace and solace she'd sought in the church? One of the monks noticed him and smiled, motioning him over. Their vow of silence had been lifted, but clearly it was also a choice. These men liked silence. Beauvoir was beginning to see why. As he arrived, the monk lifted his hat in an old-fashioned greeting. Beauvoir knelt beside him. "I'm looking for Frère Antoine," he whispered. The monk pointed a trowel toward the far wall, then went back to work. Picking his way along the orderly rows, past the weeding and harvesting monks, Beauvoir approached Frère Antoine. Weeding. Alone. The soloist. "Poor Mathieu," said Dom Philippe. "I wonder why he was here."
"Didn't you invite him? You sent Frère Simon to request a meeting."
"Yes, after the 11 o'clock Mass, not after Lord's. He was 3 hours early, if that's why he came."
"Perhaps he misunderstood."
"You didn't know Mathieu. He was rarely wrong, and never early."
"Then maybe Frère Simon gave him the wrong time."
The abbot smiled. "Simon is wrong even less of the time, although more punctual."
"And you, Dom Philippe, are you ever wrong?"
"Always and perpetually, one of the perks of the position."
Gamache smiled. He knew that perk, too. But then he remembered that while Frère Simon had headed off to give the prior a message, he hadn't found him. The message hadn't been delivered. So if it wasn't to meet the abbot, then why had the prior been here? Who was he meeting? His killer, obviously. Though equally obviously, the prior couldn't have known that was on the agenda. So what had brought Frère Mathieu to this garden?
"Why did you want to see the prior yesterday?"
"Abbey business."
"An argument could be made that everything is abbey business," said Gamache. The two men continued their stroll around the garden. "But I'd rather you didn't waste my time making that argument. I understand that you and Frère Mathieu met twice a week to discuss abbey issues. The meeting you wanted to set up yesterday was extraordinary."
Gamache's voice was reasonable, but firm. He was tired of this abbot, of all the monks, giving them facile answers. It was like copying someone else's neumes. It might be easier, but it got them no closer to their goal, if their goal was the truth.
"What was so important, Dom Philippe, that it couldn't wait until your next scheduled meeting?"
The abbot took another few steps in silence, except for the slight swish as his long black robe brushed the grass and dried leaves. "Mathieu wanted to talk about making another recording." The abbot was grim-faced.
"The prior wanted to talk about it?"
"I'm sorry?"
"You said Mathieu wanted to talk about it. Was the meeting his idea or yours?"
"The topic was his idea. The timing was mine. We needed to resolve the issue before the community met again in chapter."
"So it wasn't yet decided if there'd be another recording?"
"He decided, but I hadn't. We discussed it in chapter, but the outcome was..." The abbot searched for the right word. "Inconclusive."
"There was no consensus?"
Dom Philippe took a few paces and slipped his hands into his sleeves. It made him look contemplative, though his face was anything but thoughtful. It was bleak, an autumn face after all the leaves had fallen.
"I can ask others, you know," said the chief.
"I suspect you already have." The abbot took a deep breath, then exhaled with a puff in the early morning chill. As with most things in the monastery, some were for it, some against.
"You make it sound as though this was just one more issue to be resolved. But it was more than that, wasn't it?"
said Gamache. His words pressed, but his tone was gentle. He didn't want the abbot to put up his defences, at least not any higher than they already were. Here was a guarded man. But what was he guarding? Gamache was determined to find out.
The recording was changing the abbey, the chief pressed further, weren't they?
The abbot stopped then and cast his eyes over the wall to the forest beyond, and a single magnificent tree in full autumn colour. It shone in the sunlight, made all the brighter for the dark evergreen surrounding it. A living stained-glass window. More magnificent, surely, than anything found in a great cathedral. The abbot marvelled at it, and he marvelled at something else. How he'd actually forgotten what Saint-Gilbert had been like just a few years ago, before the recording. Everything now seemed measured by that, before and after. Saint-Gilbert entre les loups had been poor and getting poorer, before the recording. The roof leaked and pots and pans were put out by hurrying monks every time it rained. The wood stoves barely gave off enough heat. They had to put extra blankets on their cots in winter and wear their robes to bed. Sometimes, on the bitterest of nights, they'd stay up, in a dining hall, gathered around the wood stove, feeding it logs, drinking tea, toasting bread, warmed by the stove and by each other, their bodies. And sometimes, waiting for the sun to rise, they'd pray, their voices a low rumble of plain chant. And not because some bell had tolled and told them they had to, not because they were afraid of the cold or the night. They'd prayed because it gave them pleasure, for the fun of it. Mathieu was always beside him, and as they sang, Dom Philippe would notice the slight movement of Mathieu's hand, privately conducting, as though the notes and words were part of him, fused. Dom Philippe had wanted to hold that hand, to be a part of it, to feel what Mathieu felt. But of course, he never took Mathieu's hand, and never would now. That was before the recording. Now all that was gone, killed. Not by a stone to Mathieu's head. It had, in fact, been killed before that. By that damned recording. The abbot chose his words, even the ones he kept to himself, carefully. It was a damned recording, and he wished with all his heart it had never happened. This large, quiet, quite frightening man from the police had asked if he was ever wrong. He'd answered glibly that he was always wrong. What he should have said was that he was wrong many times, but one mistake overshadowed all the rest. His error had been so spectacular, so stunning, it had become a permanent wrong, in indelible ink, like the plan of the abbey. His error had soaked into the very fabric of the monastery. It now defined the abbey, and had become perpetual. What had appeared so right, so good, on so many levels, had turned into a travesty. The Gilbertine had survived the Reformation, survived the Inquisition, survived almost 400 years in the wilderness of Quebec. But they'd finally been found, and felled. And the weapon had been the very thing they'd wanted to protect, the Gregorian chants themselves. Dom Philippe would die before he'd make that mistake again. Jean-Guy Beauvoir stared at Frère Antoine. It was like peeking into an alternate universe. The monk was 38 years old, Beauvoir's age. He was Beauvoir's height, Beauvoir's colouring. They even shared the same lean and athletic build. And when he spoke, Frère Antoine's voice had the same Quebecois accent, from the same region. The streets of East End Montréal, imperfectly hidden under layers of education and effort. The two men stared, neither sure what to make of the other. "Bonjour," said Frère Antoine. "Salut," said Beauvoir. The only difference was that one was a monk and the other a sûreté officer. It was as though they'd grown up in the same house, but in different rooms. Beauvoir could understand the other monks, most were older. They seemed of an intellectual, contemplative nature, but this lean man? Beauvoir felt a slight vertigo. What could possibly have led Antoine to become Frère Antoine? Why not a cop, like Beauvoir, or a teacher, or work for Hydro-Québec, or a bum, or a vagrant, or a burden to society? Beauvoir could understand the path to all those things.
but a religious? A man of his own age, from the same streets? No one Beauvoir knew even went to church, never mind dedicated his life to it. "I understand you're the soloist for the choir," said Beauvoir. He stood as tall as he could, but still felt dwarfed by Frère Antoine. It was the robes, Beauvoir decided. They were an unfair advantage, gave the impression of height and authority. Perhaps the Sûreté should consider it, if they ever redesigned the uniforms. He'd have to put it in the suggestion box and sign Inspector Lacoste's name to it. "That's true. I'm the soloist." Beauvoir was relieved this monk hadn't called him my son. He wasn't sure what he'd do if that happened, but he suspected it wouldn't reflect well on the Sûreté. "I also understand you were about to be replaced." That got a reaction, though not the one Beauvoir expected and hoped for. Frère Antoine smiled. "You've been talking to Frère Luc, I see. I'm afraid he's mistaken." "He seems quite certain." "Frère Luc is having difficulty separating what he hopes will happen from what actually will. Expectations from reality. He's young." "I don't think he's much younger than Christ." "You're not suggesting we have the second coming in the porter's room?" Beauvoir, who had a tenuous hold on anything biblical, gave the point to the monk. "Frère Luc must have misunderstood the prior," said Frère Antoine. "Was that an easy thing to do?" Frère Antoine hesitated, then shook his head. "No," he admitted. "The prior was quite a definite man." "Then why does Frère Luc believe the prior wanted him to be the soloist?" "I can't explain what people believe, Inspector Beauvoir. Can you?" "No," admitted Beauvoir. He was looking at a man his own age, in a gown and floppy hat, head shaved, in a community of men in the woods. They dedicated their lives to a church most in Quebec had renounced, and they found meaning in singing songs in a dead language with squiggles for notes. No, he couldn't explain it. But Beauvoir knew one thing, after years kneeling beside dead bodies. It was very, very dangerous to come between a person and their beliefs. Frère Antoine handed Beauvoir a basket. The monk bent down and searched through thick elephant-ear leaves. "Why do you think Frère Luc is the portier?" the monk asked, not looking at Beauvoir. "Punishment? Some sort of hazing ritual?" Frère Antoine shook his head. "Every single one of us is assigned that little room when we first arrive." "Why?" "So we can leave." Frère Antoine picked a plump squash and put it in Beauvoir's basket. "Religious life is hard, Inspector, and this is the hardest. Not many can cut it." He made it sound like